This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, on location today with Dennis Maloney. He is a poet, a translator, a publisher, and we're going to hear his voice right now.
I'm going to open with a translation of Ryokan, a Japanese Zen poet who I co-translated with a friend of mine. Ever since I embraced the way, I cared little for the things of this world, leaving destiny to chance, in my bag three measures of rice, and by the hearth a bundle of firewood. Why worry about salvation or karma? Fortune and fame are only so much dust. On a rainy night, I stretch out my legs and fall asleep, my dwelling a tiny hut in the woods.
And another.
The other is intro poem from a sequence that I did of five-line tanka poems, Japanese-inspired, by a Japanese Zen master. Empty-handed, I entered the world. Barefoot, I leave it. My comings and goings, two simple happenings that got entangled. Kozan.
Dennis, when I read your work, and I read your Chinese and Japanese books, the whole world just melts away. I mean, I am just embraced with this calm. What is the relationship you have to these poets, and how has it been a platform for your own work?
Well, one of my major influences when I started as a writer was Gary Snyder, who led me to Japanese and Chinese poets and that sort of Zen poet tradition that goes back a couple thousand years. I spent my training in college was in landscape architecture, and I designed parks for a living for 35 years for the city of Buffalo. But I spent a semester in Kyoto studying Japanese gardens in my final year of college, but also was looking at Zen and Chinese and Japanese poetics. And so that was a formative experience for me in terms of future poetic development, for sure.
And now there's a new and selected. You have so many volumes published. So what is the title of the new and selected going to be?
It's called Clearing the Stream.
Oh, that is so exciting. From 1970, what?
1975 to 2025.
You are a worker. You are a worker. I just want to tell everyone, your own books are The Map Is Not the Territory, Just Enough, Listening to Dao Yuan Ming, The Things I Notice Now, The Faces Guan Ming Yin, and Windows. Forgive my Chinese. A bilingual German-English volume, Empty Cup, was published in Germany in 2017. His work has been translated into over a dozen languages, including full-length collections in German, Japanese, and Bulgarian. May we have a poem from Dennis Maloney.
Yes, thank you. This poem is a letter to James Wright, who was a inspiration to me when I started out as a writer, because I came from a working class background and didn't know if I could do something like write poetry. And when I found James Wright's work, he came from a similar background. So I felt a kinship to his upbringing and breaking out into poetry. Letter to James Wright. Our fathers labored in the same bitter factory. They just called that hell by a different name. Yours in hazel atlas glass and mine in the lampblack and chemicals of Hewitt Robins. They endured week after week that turned into decades, learning to tolerate what no man could ever learn to love. A life that wears a man down to a poorly functioning machine. I worked two summers in that factory and tasted the bitterness. We both ran from that ugliness, frightened we would be trapped there in a life there too. I now work in that place where you labored, facing the white page to conjure a world beyond the one into which we were born.
Mm-hmm. You know, how does the son of a factory worker dedicate his life to the life of the mind? I mean, when you look at it, what do you think made you a poet? And a translator, I mean, living to face the white page. That's quite a comment. How did you develop from that beginning?
Mainly all goes back to hearing the poet Robert Bly when I was a freshman in college. Prior to that, I'd never written poetry at all.
Oh.
And I was taking your standard freshman comp course, and our teacher said, go, this was 1970, go hear the anti-war poet and write an extra report for extra credit. And so I went, not knowing, I was obviously anti-Vietnam War at that time, and went mainly for that reason. And I certainly heard Counting the Small Bone Bodies and Teeth Mother Naked at Last, but also heard Machado and Neruda, other voices which intrigued me.
And you would wind up translating.
Yes, I largely became a poet, publisher, and translator due to hearing Robert Bly read in 1970.
Does he know? Did he ever know that?
Yes. Fortunately, I was able to know him and correspond with him a bit over the years, and we published five or six of his books, and actually have a book of his last book of essays coming out a year from now from White
Press. Imagine that happened because of a college reading.
Exactly.
That is pretty amazing. What college was that?
SUNY Brockport, State University of New York, which had at the time, back in the 70s, a great poetry series. They brought all the major writers of that time, major poets, in and had them do a reading, but also they were one of the first ones to do videotaping way back in the day before YouTube. So they have this huge archive of recorded conversations with the major poets of that day. Bly Snyder, Rex Roth, James Wright, W.S. Merwin, you know, pretty much all of that major generation of 70s poets. There's a huge archive that you can access online. It's on YouTube and stuff now.
That is good to know. So you got inspired, literally.
Exactly.
But what was the little five-year-old Dennis Maloney like?
Nothing to do with poetry, for sure.
But maybe inquisitive, maybe curious?
Yeah, I think when I started developing, elementary school, high school, was interested in both the arts and science. So my career was in landscape architecture. My day job, as we would call it, was a kind of nice blending of science and artistic. So when I sort of found that as a path to go to in college, that seemed like a blending of both sides of what I was doing. But I still, you know, still had no inclination until I got to college that I was, you know, any portents of writing. That sort of came after hearing Robert, and then reading his books and going back, like from him, I traced back into the European and South American poets that he translated. So I learned a lot, you know, through sort of following the trails that they created. And the same with Snyder, with Asian poetry.
50 years worth, 50 years of facing the white page.
It's
quite an accomplishment. Let us have another poem. Dennis Maloney.
This one's called Before Experience. 40 years ago, when I first saw the remarkable misty landscape paintings of China, Japan, and thought they were products of some artistic convention. But years later, rounding a curve on a train in the Japanese mountains, I suddenly was in one of those paintings and realized the artist painted what they saw. Not recording every rock and leaf, but the momentary urgency of life itself, eliminating all but the essential, brushed in quick strokes on fragile paper, held together now by little more than ink and their own strength. Now I live on the edge of the continent and watch some mornings as the wisps of fog drift in from the ocean. Suddenly ocean and coast disappear, and soon Wildcat Ridge vanishes too. A delicate hand paints the landscape with mist and leaves a slight dampness behind. And that poem comes from, for about a dozen years, we lived part-time in Big Sur, California, kind of to get out of the Buffalo winters, but we found a place in a canyon off of Highway 1 with a hint of ocean view. But what amazed me was, which coming from Buffalo, New York, where we live most of the time, the effects of mist in that landscape, because it doesn't happen in the Western New York.
I understand. I lived in Del Mar for a while, and that mist just came right into my house, right into my house. The momentary urgency of life itself. The momentary urgency of life itself. I finally have a definition for poetry. That is a perfect definition. But you're a very busy producer. You're a publisher. What is the title of your press?
White Pine Press.
Yes. And you have a significant press, publishing the best of the best. But when I read your work and following you a little bit from the distance, I always feel you lead a rather monastic life. So I get that. I get that meditative state beneath your work. Then how do you balance being of the world, they say, and not of the world, in the world, but not really of it? What is that balance? What is your life like?
I think it's pretty mundane a lot of times, but I think I try to balance both. Like in some of my other work, I've had the good fortune to be invited to Europe a number of times for festivals and such, and have written about out of that. And later I'll read a poem from Border Crossings, which is a sequence I wrote out of several of those European trips. So I think the one side of my poetry is meditative, but the other side is looking out at the world and trying to grapple with the social issues and things that we deal with on a daily basis, particularly in these coming times that starting next January 20th, we'll have another reality to perhaps resist and figure out how to deal with. But it's also, in looking at the way we deal with that and looking how many poets in many European countries deal with living under various forms of dictatorship or oligarchy or such. So we find ways to keep the spirit alive even in troubling times.
And that's what you do, Dennis Maloney. Let's hear more poetry.
Okay, this is a poem that probably took me 50 years to write. I went to when I was I think between junior and sophomore year in high school. Or junior and senior year, I talked to my father and letting me go to New York for a week on my own. And Janis Joplin happened to be playing at the Fillmore East, and she was one of my, this was before they had their first really big record out. I mean, I think their first album had been out, but it was before they made a major hit after Monterey. But, and I, so I certainly knew who she was, and it was left a tremendous impression on me, but it took a long time to figure out how to write the poem. Janice, who was that boy of 17 wandering the streets of New York alone for the first time, hip to the music but not the street, still living in the house of his father between the vagaries and scars of youth? 50 years later, warm waves of memory flood the brain when I hear your voice again, preserved now on this scratchy acetate disc, remembering that humid night of early August 68 at the Fillmore East, you taking the stage with Big Brother, wild hair, granny glasses, bangles, bracelets, baubles, vibrant, electric, prancing, breast almost bouncing out of a tight dress, hiding the wound that never heals. Voice bursting out, caressing each word with tenderness, each song ravaged, shredded, singing down the wind like a ravaging gale. The audience awed that one human being could give so much of herself away.
Dennis, I know why that took you 50 years. That last verse, that last, can you read it again? Just the last verse.
Sure. Voice bursting out, caressing each word with tenderness, each song ravaged, shredded, singing down the wind like a raging gale. The audience awed that one human being could give so much of herself away.
How much should we give away? That is why it took you so long to reach that profound philosophic principle. I could teach a course in philosophy with your work, but the question is, how much do we, should we, can we give away? And did she get enough back? Why didn't she get enough in return, Dennis? I love Janis Joplin. I mean, she is my idol. I was much older than you when she came on the scene. But oh, what that, I have never understood what her grasp was on us until I read that line. How much she gave away of herself. But if we get what we want, will it kill us?
I don't know. I mean, in her case, I think it may be. I mean, she lived a life obviously very hard, and particularly with the extensive drug use, which some of which I don't think came out until after she died, reading biographies and such. But I remember one quote, probably from a biography or something, picked up somewhere that she said something along the line, "I made love to 30,000 people on the stage, but went home alone at night." So
There's
I think
that,
she had a lot of aloneness in her,
There is,
but yeah. she put everything out.
Everything.
Yeah, I mean, there's not many. I mean, I've seen other performers who probably match her in terms of what they give to the audience, but she just, you know, threw her whole spirit, body, everything into
no protection.
Yeah,
no protection. Yes, that's the first one I've read of her that I finally knew what she died of, really. So let's have another poem, Dennis Maloney.
Okay, this comes from a sequence called Border Crossings that we were speaking of a few minutes ago. It started with going to a poetry festival in the Black Forest of Germany that I was invited to. And it was at the time of the first Syrian migrations into Europe, before the huge wave came. This is back maybe 10 years ago. But it was seeing the displacement, and the sequence goes through a lot of things. It's one of those sequences that you started out in one place and didn't know where it was going to end. And I'm just going to read one poem from that sequence. And this one has to do with translation, because a lot of the poets there were also translators, but also being in a place where multiple languages are spoken. Thankfully for me, English is the lingua franca of most of these festivals, so you can get by being kind of monolingual. But being a translator myself and talking with other translators, this poem sort of arose from that. On dark nights when I have no words of my own, translations calm me. Let me jump in letter by letter, soaking up the dampness of the words. I hear a whispering sigh like the sea in the dark, as both poem and self exist in a constant state of becoming. What draws us as a translator to seek an equivalent music from one tongue to another? Affinities, a vibrancy, listening to the meanings that reside flowering beyond the thickness of dictionaries. Nibbling at the edges of the poem, we give contours to shadows. How do we translate the silence that lives between the lines? I am a nomad searching for a language in which I am a word unbound, wandering between the world we inhabit and the world we create.
Nowhere is the act of translation better told there. That's the essence of it. That's where you live.
And I think, you know, the process of translation is a delicate one, particularly for poetry. My feeling, and that of many others, is you need to be a poet to translate poetry.
No question.
Like, we've all seen many
lockstep
translations done of by, say, professors of a language who know the original language but don't know what a poem is. So they come out very wooden and very flat. And so you need the spark of a poet to recreate that in the new language. And in my career, I've done mainly co-translations where I don't know either language well. I've done from Spanish and Japanese, but I work with co-translators, and what I brought to the table, hopefully, is making them good poems in English, like trying to recreate some of the original in a new language.
But Dennis, doesn't the translator have to give up ego before she starts?
Yeah, I would say for the most part, yes. I mean, I think it's for a poet, it's a really a deep dive into another person's work, and you learn from translating, because that's it helps your own practice, I think, as a poet, because it gives you a different way of looking at it. I mean, I think some translators, like perhaps in the case of a translator like Robert Bly, who translated from many languages, sometimes some of his translations came out a little bit sounding too much like Robert Bly poems. But it isn't a bad thing. No, it isn't a bad thing either, but it's a careful dance. I mean, but you can read, I mean, for example, poets like Rilke and Neruda have been translated by many different translators, the same poem. So you can, as an exercise, go through and read maybe five or six translations of the same poem by different hands.
True.
And see where they did, you know, which is kind of maybe an academic or poetic study, but sometimes it's fascinating to see.
Fascinating.
What choices people made in terms of, you know, working on like a poem of several stanzas and see, you know, where they ended up.
I have a group that meets every month and does exactly that. Now, your own works include these: The Stones of Chile by Pablo Neruda, The Landscape of Castile by Antonio Machado, Between the Floating Mist poems of Ryokan, and The Poet and the Sea by Juan Ramon Jimenez. That's just some of your translations. You have must be 100 years old. How many? I mean, does it take a
73,
year?
But not 100 yet.
How does it take a year to do a translation?
Sometimes it takes a while. I mean, I started after I heard Robert Bly. I started trying to translate a book of Neruda with 2 years of high school Spanish and a dictionary, but found that was rather tedious. So it was much easier to collaborate with somebody who was more fluent in the language. But like I did two major books with a friend of mine, Mary Berg. We did the Campos de Castillo of Antonio Machado, The Landscape of Castile, and the Poet in the Sea by Juan Ramon Jimenez. And both of those probably took about 5 years apiece because we were both working full time at other things. She was in the academy and I was working as a landscape architect. Mm-hmm. So we would just send like a half a dozen poems back and forth and, you know, work on them slowly, work through the book.
And negotiate.
Yeah, and negotiate. Like she would sometimes come back and say, well, I would try to make it more poetic. And she'd come back and say, well, I don't see that in the original. So then we'd have to go back and sort of compromise on, you know, I would have to find a different way of expressing that phrase or something to get
exactly
to what I wanted. So it was a nice, but it was a nice dance to work with somebody and, you know, sort of go back and forth. And interestingly, when my own work's been translated, I've had a chance to work with the translators, and sometimes, you know, they ask me questions. Unfortunately, all the poets that I've co-translated were dead, so I didn't have to
need
that.
That's true. But we need you. Thank you for your service, if I must
Thank
say
you.
That. If we don't have them, we have no bridges whatsoever to the world. Yes, but translation must be kind of a meditative practice because you get so immersed in this bubble. It has to be good for the soul. I mean, it has to be very good for the body.
Definitely.
No, it's intellectual, but it really is an immersion, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely an immersion on with you know, getting to know one author very well. And I think like Kenneth Rexroth, I think, was the one who said, if you're in between writing your own work, translation is a good practice to sort of keep your hand in it.
Good you point know, to, for language.
Keep, and I mean, for in my life, when I was working full time and also part-time running the publishing company that I run, I didn't have a lot of energy to devote to writing my own work. So translation sort of kept me in the game, if you will, for a number of years, right? Because translation was a little bit easier to work on because you weren't having to, the creative work was there. You were sort of massaging it and working into a new language, but it required for me less energy than working on my own work.
Yeah, but you have to be kind of a nerd too. You like to be it's a very scholarly thing. It's very intellectual. So not everyone can take a break from their own writing to do that. But what do you get back? I mean, I know you get the satisfaction from completing the work, but what do you get back from
I think it energizes and enriches your own work. It gives you, like, I've been recently working on a few poems on Antonio Machado and rereading his work because I just feel like a kinship there and have been, you know, sort of delving into his life and looking at very, you know, because he lived in a interesting time. I mean, he was very much a loner. He was married for a brief period, but his wife died of tuberculosis early on, so he led kind of a solitary life. But he was a kind of a lot of his poetry is very on the meditative side.
Yeah, but wasn't he very peripatetic? Wasn't he a traveler?
He didn't travel too much. He went to Paris for a while, but he mainly lived in Spain. He made his living as a high school French teacher, actually, for most of his life. But he was on the side of the Republic during the Spanish Civil War, so he was involved in that and wrote a terrific poem about Lorca's death. When Lorca was assassinated early in the Spanish Civil War. And then he wrote a lot of prose work on the side of the Republic because he was probably in his 60s or something during the time of the years of the Republic. And then he ended up being exiled into Spain, like across the border in a village called Colher at the end of his life and died there like a couple months after after the fall of the Spanish Republic, and he was forced into exile in France. So he didn't live very long after the fall of the Republic in the late 30s.
And to write political poetry, which is true poetry, is rare and beautiful. Let us have two poems from you together and set them up, please.
Sure. These are from my most recently published book, which is entitled Windows. And it has an epigraph from Rainer Maria Rilke, which I'll read. Window, are you not our geometry whose simple shape circumscribes effortlessly this enormous life? And the opening poem in the book is, this glass pane of the window serves to frame the view within and without, a transparent gate through which light passes and at the same time a mirror reflecting life on the street smudged and streaked with rain. This book is a window looking out on a shifting landscape. And the book sort of began with looking at the metaphor of windows and doing many things with that, and then it sort of expanded out into you could see anything through a window, kind of. And this is a poem in tribute to Robert Bly, who, as we previously discussed, was one of the first poet that really set me on this course 50 years later of writing, publishing, and translating.
Imagine one person just handing you the baton. I just can't get over that. I just can't get over that. Let's hear it.
Okay. Driving country roads, the first flurries of November dance along the pavement. A late night message from a friend tells me you have faded from the fog of the last few years, slipping quietly into whatever exists next. Robert, you speculated about so much, infuriating and bewildering some, but inspiring and enchanting many. Hearing a poem of Yeats in high school, you decided to write poetry the rest of your life. You asked yourself if you had wasted your life sitting indoors writing poetry and said no, you would do it again 1,000 times. Robert, I heard your poems and translations of Machado in college like you heard Yeats. Those poems made me follow the path of poetry nurtured by those words. And yes, I would do it again 1,000 times.
Dennis, would you do your life again 1,000 times?
Yes, maybe parts of it differently, but yes.
Everyone says, if they could just abridge it a little bit.
Of course. And I was honored, speaking of Robert Bly, who we previously mentioned, I had met several times and heard read over his life. One of his versions of selected poems came out, I realized what wasn't included in the selected poems. And I, with a friend of his who was his sort of executive assistant for many years, a poet in his own right, Thomas Smith, we went through and put together a volume of 160-some poems that weren't in the selected works.
Oh.
And published those as a book of poems, as sort of as a companion to what was in the selected works at the time. And it came out, we launched it at when the AWP was in Minneapolis, maybe a dozen years ago.
Oh, I was there, yeah.
And they had a tribute panel to Robert at the AWP. And then afterwards, a friend of his put together a reading from the book of like 25 poets, mainly from the Twin Cities, but a few people who stayed around, like Tony Hoagland after the AWP, that were inspired by Robert's work. And each one of us read one or two poems each from Robert's work. And then Robert read a few poems. I don't know if you know that Robert, for the last about 10 years of his life, was in dementia.
He
read some poems from the book, which was amazing. And I didn't find out till later when my friend sent me a recorded disc of the reading. It was his last public reading that he did. So I heard him in 1970, who started my career as a poet, and the book that I published of his work was his last public reading. So it was, for me, a nice return of the gift that was given to me to give back, you know, to him, that
Dennis,
to publish his work.
What a story. It came full circle. As they fly away from us like meteors, we are grateful for Dennis Maloney for making permanent some of these great voices, both international and national. And we would love a final poem, Dennis Maloney.
Okay. This is from a book that I'm currently working on. It's centered on the Dutch painter Vermeer, who, for some reason, I got fascinated with painting some years ago and started when I was traveling, particularly in Europe. There's a bunch of his paintings in New York and Washington and in this country. But every time I would go to a European country, I tried to track down some of his paintings. And then about a year and a half ago, The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam had a major show of his work. They brought together, there's only about 35 of his paintings extant that exist. There's a few others that they think they can trace in historic references that didn't survive. But the Rijksmuseum had 28 out of his 35 paintings in one place for the first time ever in our lifetime. So I went to see that, which was an impetus to sort of kickstart. I was working on the book before that, but when I saw this exhibit was going to be there, definitely had to go see that. This poem is one of the more recent poems I wrote, and it's called Vermeer in a Time of War, which was partly inspired by a book, an essay called Vermeer in Bosnia, when the Bosnian War was over and they arrested some of the criminals and they were tried at the International Court in The Hague. This essay point was discussing that one of the judges would go to look at the paintings in the museum in The Hague, that has half a dozen of his paintings. He would go there just to calm his mind after hearing all this terrible news of the war in Bosnia, sitting during the day. So this is a Vermeer in war, and since looking at in his day, there was a lot of wars as well as in our time. As New Year arrives, wars are raging on two or three continents. Minor skirmishes that rarely make the headlines erupt in a half a dozen places. From Ukraine to Israel to Gaza, sieges, famines, massacres. The world is becoming frayed and some days seems to fracture into pieces. Day after day, people check the list of the dead in search of familiar names. A child doesn't care if he dies by knife, gun, indiscriminate bomb, or starves to death. Europe was awash in violence, in wars of violence, cruelty that lasted decades, the 30 Years' War, the 80 Years' War. Yet in your paintings, everything is clean, bright, and perfectly composed, radiating a peacefulness and serenity far different from the reality outside the room. The French invasion of 1672, known as the disaster year, devastated the economy and collapsed the art market. Was it too much to endure? How did you cope with the heartache of a world falling into ruin? Skeletons are never far away. We continue to unearth the bones from beneath the rubble of collapsed buildings, and sometimes we sleep above them. Their ghosts inhabit our dreams.
And Dennis Maloney makes poetry out of those dreams. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Production. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Sinipet Fund, Rivada Foundation, Avide Shoshani, Sandy Jackson Cohen, and Natalie Canavore. Mike Turpin is our engineer, and I'm Grace Cavalieri.